This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
Well, it's great to have Will Grigg with us today. William Norman Grigg is an author. He has a very important website, freedominourtimes.blogspot.com. He writes for LouRockwell.com. Take a look at his archive. Will, you're an expert in many things, but today I want to talk to you about something that seems to me you've been such a prescient and eloquent commentator on, and that's the American police state. In fact, your wonderful new book is exactly on that topic. Tell us a little bit about your book first.
Oh, I appreciate that. My book is entitled Liberty and Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And, of course, it focuses primarily on what's happened after the day everything purportedly changed, which was 9/11 2001. But it talks about trends that would have led us in the same direction and probably would have placed us in more or less the same location we are today in terms of the militarization of law enforcement and the federalization of what had been locally accountable police departments. There are some pretty serious and sober thinkers who believe and make a good case for the proposition that the police that we have today, the professional government-run police that we have, are unconstitutional and a bad idea to begin with, and that you should be privatizing a lot of the functions that the police carry out, that perhaps we should have sheriff's departments and not the professional police forces that we have. But whether or not that's a sound proposition, under the constitutional system we had until the last few decades, the police were locally accountable. They lived in the communities where they served. They looked upon themselves as peace officers whose job was to protect the lives, the liberty, and the property of the local community, the members of the local community. And now we've reached a point where police are increasingly and obviously acting like an army of occupation, and that reflects a lot of the trends that were visible before 9/11, but that actually and obviously accelerated after 9/11, where we've seen police departments become more and more affiliates of the Pentagon and of what I call the Homeland Security State, which is to say they're getting more and more of their money, more and more of their material and training from the Pentagon and from the federal government, and they're oriented more toward the federal government than toward the local communities. And so now they're not considering themselves as a peace force with the mission of protecting the local community so much as they are a force intended to compel local communities to submit to the will of this unitary state that we're living under.
Just recently, there was a case in the news of an Iraq war vet who was tried in a civilian court for having shot a bunch of prisoners. They were civilian prisoners. An entire family shot them in the head when they were blindfolded. The Army didn't charge him, and then he turned out to be charged in a civilian court, and the jury unfortunately found him not guilty. And he said afterwards he was looking forward to returning to his job as a cop.
Yes.
And so, you know, it seems to me maybe it's a direct Pentagon order. Maybe it's a matter of a subsidy from Homeland Security or from the Pentagon. But it seems like every police department is hiring, if they can get away with it, only Iraq war vets. And, of course, these sometimes are kids who are damaged before they went over there, maybe damaged while they were there. And people who, of course, you know, look at us as a bunch of insurgents.
That's exactly right. As a matter of fact, a lot of the vocabulary you hear in the so-called surge in Iraq is taken from not the classic doctrines of anti-insurrectionary warfare, but actually from inner city police operations here in the United States, this idea of clearing and holding territory. The first time I actually found that expression being used was about a decade ago with reference to operations by SWAT teams and tactical teams in some urban areas in California where they were putting down what they described as potential insurrections by urban street gangs or simply by urban populations that were looked upon as the spawning ground for street gangs. It's the same preemptive mindset really that led to the misadventure in Iraq, the idea that there are people who understand the trends and that in order to abort a trend toward militarization of a given community by urban street gangs, you have to go in and clear and hold territory. That was actually going on in this country before they applied it to certain neighborhoods in Baghdad and Anbar province, whatever else you want to mention in Iraq. But when you talk about the fact that we're seeing this creation of a law enforcement body here in the United States that draws heavily upon veterans of the Iraq War, that is a very troubling development because the mindsets of police and military personnel, respectively, are completely different and utterly incompatible. Somebody who's in the military traditionally has been taught to look upon whatever population he's deposited in as a pool of either enemies or potential enemies. And, of course, that creates a mindset which is one in which they're ready at any given second to erupt in lethal violence against the people who surround them. And a law enforcement officer traditionally is not supposed to have that mindset. He's supposed to be looking at the population as people he's supposed to be serving and protecting. And criminal suspects are not looked upon as a military target to be destroyed. They're looked upon as citizens with due process rights that have to be protected until such time as they're proven to be guilty. Even if they're criminal suspects, they're still innocent before the law, and they can't be summarily dispatched the way that an enemy can. The thing that I'm finding is I've researched this issue of the personnel pool from which law enforcement is drawing now in the era of the interminable Iraq war, is that a lot of the people who are going over to Iraq are coming from reserve and guard units that draw heavily from sheriff's departments and police departments, and often SWAT teams and other tactical teams. And a lot of the incidents that I've read about where there have been abuses of Iraqi civilians actually involve people who are American law enforcement officers who are serving the military tour of duty in Iraq as reservists or guardsmen. And that's pretty scary when you recognize the fact that some of the professional military people over there are appalled by incidents of needless abuse and violence committed by reservists who, when they come back home, will take off their military uniform and then don the uniform of the state patrol or the sheriff's department. That's a pretty scary prospect.
Well, there was a story in the New York Times a couple of months ago about a guy who'd applied to become a cop in Connecticut and had been turned down because his IQ was too high.
Yes.
And so he brought a suit about this, and it turns out that this is a formal policy apparently all across the country to make sure they don't hire anybody who's too smart as a cop, because of course they might be questioning orders. Maybe they wouldn't be good little boys and girls and shoot whomever they're told to shoot. So this of course got virtually no attention, although give credit to the New York Times, they did have a story on it. They thought it was fine too, of course, that brighter people are blocked from police work. But I know as a kid, and maybe because I grew up in a very comfortable middle-class suburb, I had what I think of in retrospect as a far too rosy view of the local police. And I can remember when I first read Malcolm X and other people referring to the police as occupation forces, I thought that was crazy. Of course, Malcolm X was right. And black communities at that time were being subjected to this. You know, now everybody is. Yet there seems to be very few dissenting voices. You're so eloquent on this, and you're so on target. But I must say, outside of LRC and very few other places, Will, you know, maybe Glenn Greenwald at Salon, very few people are even alarmed or even interested in what's going on.
Well, a lot of people have been, like you described, and as was in my case, have been marinated in this romantic view of the local beat cop as an officer-friendly type of a figure. And as a young man, I used to go out, when it was possible to do this, on ride-alongs with the sheriff's deputy after I finished work at a local restaurant when I was 16, 17 years old. You can never do that now. Here in Idaho, I live in a little town in southwestern Idaho, about 7,000 population. You can't ride as a passenger in a police car unless you're in the back seat with your hands cuffed anymore. That's a really good illustration of the differing attitudes that are taking hold of police departments now, and the way that they're being trained, acculturated, to look upon the public as the enemy. That, of course, is something that is very slow to be reciprocated by the public at large, because particularly now, once again, in the post-9/11 era, we're constantly bombarded with the images of some of the admittedly heroic things that happened after the attack in New York City, where you had very brave police officers dashing in to rescue people, and that sort of a thing, of course, tends to color our perceptions of police as people, as a group of individuals, and you don't take a look at the policies that are being handed down and the conduct that is resulting from the policies. People don't understand we are talking about a government program, and government at its very essence is organized coercion, lethal coercion in principle, at least threatened lethal coercion. And one of the things that has happened just in recent years, you made reference to this case in Connecticut of the individual who wasn't allowed to become a police officer because he was too intelligent, is that there is this deliberate effort. I've noticed at least a handful of cases I can document to winnow out from the pool of applicants people who would tend to be either too individualistic simply to accept orders because they're orders from a superior, or people who have a moral code rooted in Christianity and Christian ethics that would forbid them to do certain things that are facially unconstitutional and that are unjust in an obvious way. There's one case I wrote about involving a man by the name of Ramon Perez in Austin, Texas, who was very successful businessman who in his late 30s decided he wanted to become a police officer to serve his local community. He went to the academy and was the outstanding cadet at the academy. He had natural leadership gifts. He was a lay pastor in an independent Christian church, a homeschooling father, a very handsome man with a beautiful family, and he only lasted about 6 months on the job because about 6 months into his job, he was ordered to use a taser against a nonviolent but resisting elderly suspect who could be subdued without the use of strong-arm tactics. The man was involved in some kind of a domestic dispute with his elderly wife, and so Ramon Perez, rather than using his taser, used what he called soft-hand tactics to take the man into custody. And as a result of violating this direct order that was against the Austin PD's own taser use policy, in addition to being against the state constitution of Texas and the U.S. Constitution's due process guarantees and any basic sense of Christian proportionate justice, he was eventually cashiered from the police department after being run through a thoroughly demeaning psychological profile session. They found out that he was incompatible with his job because he had this unyielding sense of right and wrong rooted in Christian ethics. So they flushed him from the police department. Like I said, I've got several cases that are very similar to this where people are being excluded from consideration as police officers because of their strong moral views and because of the fact that they have sufficient individual sense of self and sufficient intelligence to question things that are not right when they're ordered to do something that violates this sense of propriety. And so they're obviously looking to fill the rank and file police departments with people who will robotically follow orders no matter how manifestly wrong they might be. And that, of course, is very troubling as well because police, traditionally, back when they were merely a flawed, part of a flawed institution rather than the one that we're seeing today, which is a fully functioning apparatus of suppression. Back in the day when you merely were dealing with flawed police officers, they could exercise discretion, and a lot of them could be trusted to exercise discretion because they understood the value of this moral code rooted in our Christian heritage. And today that's considered grounds for disqualification if you want to become a police officer. Now, no good can come of that.
Well, certainly, as we see decentralism and states' rights and local rights being abolished, I was going to say eroded, but really being abolished. And
Yeah. We
live in, of course, in a very highly centralized state of a sort of a Napoleonic sort.
Yeah.
The police, of course, are no longer responsible even to the mayor, and that's maybe bad enough, but they're responsible to the Homeland Security Department and to the federal government, and they're funded oftentimes, at least in part, by these agencies. I remember it all going back to the evil Richard Nixon and his law Enforcement Assistance Administration. This was one of the great conservative policies that helped get Nixon and Agnew elected. So this has been going on for some time. It's time we blew the whistle, the police whistle maybe on it. And you're the leader, and thanks so much for coming on today and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Read Will's book, Liberty in Eclipse. Take a look at his archive on lewrockwell.com.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by lewrockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@lewrockwell.com. And thanks for listening.